Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week of December the 24th, 2018. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zoller, sitting here in Phoenix, where it's actually pretty nice now, right now. I know lots of other places it's not so nice, but I'm back here now for a little while. I'll be heading off to the New York area later this week on a personal trip, so I'm actually going to be doing any sessions up there. But then I'll be heading back into Connecticut the following week, so I've got a few things going on coming up for this month. And it was a busier week than I thought it was going to be, given that the end of last week we had the IRS issuing a lot of documents right at the end. But certain things happened this week, and we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll hold a couple of them for next week, because especially with the government shutdown, you know, at some point here, we should run out of things to talk about. So I've got a couple of them delayed because we just have so much going on this week. So we'll talk briefly about a couple of them, one of which was the partnership audit final regulations on the new comprehensive partnership audit regime did come out this week. I haven't had time to go through them in detail, so I plan to talk a little bit more about them next week, but they look to be pretty much in line with what the last set of proposed regs gave us with some minor changes. You know, we've had other neat things happen. We've had all the neat little things discussed about certain issues related to the 199 Cap A proposed regs. An interesting issue I'm following right now about publication 535, which appears to list real estate agents and insurance agents as specified service trader businesses, which, of course, not what the proposed reg said. So that'll be some stuff that next week we'll take a look at, see if we got any more clarification what's going on. But this week we've got a whole lot of things to talk about. First thing is, the Blue Book came out. Just about on the one-year anniversary of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the Blue Book dropped from the Joint Committee on Taxation. So we have the Blue Book to work with now with explanations, some of which contradict the proposed regulations. So we'll take a look at some of the things in there that we might give us some guidance or some information, and whether or not the regs will actually take this into account will be kind of interesting. We got a news about the fact that if you're going to get your full tax credit for your Tesla, you're running out of time. You need to get that Tesla bought real quick here. We'll talk about that. We had a memo come down about MFP payments for farmers that are receiving those payments due to issues that arose due to basically damage that occurred to their ability to sell their crop due to trade issues. The IRS rules on the tax status of those. The auto mileage rates for 2019 are now out. We have a case involving a management company who managed a marijuana dispensary, and did they actually avoid the disallowance of their expenses? And finally, we have a very limited amount of information that the IRS released on the excess loss rules and operating loss rules that were passed under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. But before we get going with this, I do want to wish everybody here a hopefully enjoyable holiday. I know this is coming out on Monday the 24th, but I expect a lot of you are not actually going to be listening to it then. Some of you probably won't hear this until next year because you're gone off for family, friends, etc. for the whole week. But in any event, we hope you have an enjoyable holiday, or you had an enjoyable holiday, from all of us here on Kaplan Accounting for Continuing Education. And we look forward to working with you this year. With that, let's get started and take a look at the Blue Book. We have one now, otherwise known as General Explanation of Public Law 115-97, JCS 1-1-18 is the document number. It actually was published on the 20th of this month, so we had to come out on the 20th, came out late in the week. This is the Joint Committee on Taxation staff explanation of the provisions in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Now, interestingly enough, it was pointed out when I was on Twitter this week, that this particular time, the Blue Book does not include something it usually does, which is the reason for the change. In essence, the Joint Committee on Taxation, for whatever reason, left out reason for the change of this Blue Book. Normally, a Blue Book has that as part of each section, the rationale for why Congress changed the provision. Maybe that we couldn't decide what that rationale was. We're not quite sure what the issue is, but we definitely are missing that. That's a bit unusual, but it doesn't mean it's going to be a really short book. It's got over 400 pages for your reading enjoyment to go through. There are a few things in the book that are of interest. One of which is there's a very odd section 199 Cap A example that tells us a rental in there at example qualified for the 199 Cap A deduction because apparently it's a trader business. But the example may raise more questions than it solves, because it had apparently a requirement for separate books and records. It had other issues. This particular rental had various three businesses that were renting the lower floors of the building, then had a bunch of tenants renting the upstairs floors. And it's not clear if that's the kind of situation one must have to have a rental be a trader business, where that's just a simple example of a trader business, but we don't need anything that far. So while it looked kind of promising as an example right away, didn't feel it was so promising once I read it. We also discovered one interesting thing on the excess business loss deduction. According to the Joint Committee staff, the intention was that wages should not count as business income in determining if you have over $500,000 of excess business losses or $250,000 if you're not married filing joint return. The law itself doesn't state that. And in fact, the Joint Committee Blue Book suggests they need a technical correction to make that happen. I would also point out that the IRS's Form 461, the draft version that is going to be used to compute this limitation, for the moment includes wages as business income. So it's kind of an interesting thing whether the form will be changed, whether Congress will actually do a technical correction on this. There's all kinds of interesting things. And one example that just may flat out be wrong, because what I think was happening here was the author of the Blue Book was trying to illustrate something, and he decided to use example years that probably he shouldn't have used. But in one of their examples about how you compute qualified business income, based upon the fact that you pick up losses or income near which they hit the return, not the year in which they originally generated. They use the example of having a passive activity loss carryover from 2017. In 2018, you're allowed to use that up for whatever reason. And they said, well, in 2018, it reduces the qualified business income. The problem is the proposed regulations told us that pre-2018 passive activity loss carryovers would not reduce QBI when they were released. Now, again, does that mean that, you know, the proposed regs were not in line with Congress? Does that mean that the proposed regs, the final regs when they come out, would change that? We're not sure what it means, but that is an interesting one to keep your eye on. And again, this is all part of the Blue Book of the Joint Committee on Taxation. There are some interesting things in there, certainly a lot of issues. You'll notice that there are a lot of sections in the footnotes where you're going to find them say a technical correction may be necessary to achieve this, you know, this goal of the law. There are a bunch of them in there. You know, we've got those. We've got a ton of them. It is certain at this point Congress is not going to pass them before Congress leaves. In fact, Chairman Brady of the House Ways and Means Committee, we should say outgoing Chairman Brady of the House Ways and Means Committee, is putting together a draft technical corrections bill that is using the Blue Book as the place to get the technical corrections from. But even he admits that it's not even going to be submitted to the House this year to pass. It's going to be something that's just to start next year. And remember that next year he will no longer be the chair of Ways and Means. So whether in fact his draft goes anywhere or it's just one of those neat little exercises because, you know, he's going to be stuck in Washington for a while due to voting on the funding issues, not quite sure, but we have that out there. So in any event, go get your copy of the Blue Book. Next up, if your client's wanting to get the electrical vehicle credits by buying a Tesla, they better hurry. Notice 2018-96, issued on December the 14th. Tesla has now hit the $200,000 vehicle limit. So they've sold over 200,000 vehicles that qualify for the electric car credit. Because of that, remember we've had this in the past. You may remember years ago, we ran into this early on with the Priuses. When Toyota had sold enough of those, we began phasing out their credit. Now the Teslas have the credit being phased out. The credit's going to be reduced. If you want to get the full 100% credit, you have to go and get your car purchased by the end of 2018. So essentially, if you're listening to this on Monday, you've got less than a week. You got basically a week to get it done. If you're listening to this since 2019, as you're too late. For the first half of 2019, we'll get 50% of the credit. So you buy your car by June 30, 2019, get your Tesla by June 30, then you'll get half the credit. If you don't get your car till the second half of the year, you'll get 25% of the standard credit. After 2019, no credit. So 2020 and later years, if you buy a Tesla, what you pay for the Tesla is what you're going to have to pay in total. There'll be no tax credits to allow you to offset the cost of the Tesla. Next up, We have these payments have been made under the Market Facilitation Program to farmers. Under Program Manager Technical Advice 2018-021, issued on December the 10th, the IRS looked in this memo at the tax status of payments made to farmers under this Market Facilitation Program. The Market Facilitation Program is meant, you probably remember hearing about this, as the tariffs began to be put on the soybeans in retaliation for U.S. tariffs on other products. The U.S. government announced they're going to be giving about $12 billion, put $12 billion into a fund that would be used to reimburse farmers who were damaged by this. Most of that goes into the MFP program. The question became, what's the taxation if you receive payments under the MFP program? The IRS looked back at prior programs and prior situations where funds have been transferred to farmers under various situations. And they determined these payments very much like subsidy payments made to farmers under prior programs. The idea being they're not getting as much for their soybeans today, and it's mainly soybeans is a big category that gets most of the payments here. Some others do, but soybeans is the big area that was affected by these tariffs. That, you know, the price they're getting for their soybeans is lower than they should have because they've been tariffed out of the Chinese market. So because of that, we're going to give them this extra money, which works out to be, as they're effectively saying here, is a subsidy to those farmers. As a subsidy, the IRS ruled that is both subject to the regular income tax. So in Code Section 61, these payments under MFP have to be included as taxable income. They're lost profits payments. And so as such, they're taxable payments from the farm. And they're also subject to self-employment tax. So they're part of the trade or business of the farmer operating the farm. For that reason, they're also SE income. Again, these payments that came this year, if you have clients who have these payments, I think you were probably assuming they'd be taxable in full. But now we have an IRS memo that essentially says, yeah, that's the services position. They're going to be taxable in full. Well, if you're not driving the Tesla, you still may be interested in the auto mileage rates for next year. And notice 2019-02 that was issued on December the 14th of 2018 gave us the updated mileage rates for next year. The mileage for business use is going to go to 58 cents a mile next year, beginning January 1st. So that's used, you know, when driving around, if you want to reimburse your employees for their mileage and not have to worry about them, including any income, not have to worry about the other issues. They just keep their mileage records, 58 cents a mile is available. If you're driving around for charitable purposes, it's going to be 14 cents a mile in 2019. Moving expenses, medical expenses, say they tell us what that is. That's 20 cents a mile next year. Moving expenses, this is the one they told us the number. It is 20 cents a mile. But remember, aside from those in the armed services in certain situations, basically moving expenses are not going to be deductible. So that one is virtually a who cares. They also told us the depreciation rate. They added the rate for 2019 with these mileage rates. And using the mileage rates, the depreciation will be considered at 26 cents a mile, will be considered depreciation on a vehicle. That will reduce its basis when it's later sold. So you've got that. This particular notice has the rates going back a number of years, how much depreciation you got to charge off for the amounts used in each of those years. Next up, we have the marijuana case again. You got to love it. This marijuana cases are always a little bit fun. This is section 280E. This one is a case of alternative health care advocates versus commissioner. This is case number 151 TC number 13. It was issued on December the 20th of 2018. The tax court brought this down. Now, it's a published tax court case because this one is a little different. As we all know, Section 280E of the code, or at least hopefully you do if you're anywhere near any of these sorts of transactions, if you sell a controlled substance, and marijuana is a federally controlled substance, and the law looks at either federally or state controlled to trigger this. So you got a federally controlled substance, you're selling marijuana. A lot of places are doing that now because in a lot of states, the state has made it legal. It's still illegal federally, but the feds have not really done much in the way of enforcement recently in this area. So these sales are going on. Here in Arizona, we have it as medical marijuana. Of course, the states have now moved beyond that. You see Colorado led the way, which is generally making it legal. And now we've seen other states move to pure legality of the marijuana, which means we now have dispensaries setting up and selling marijuana. But since the federal government still considers it to be illegal, under 280E, No business expenses, except for cost of sales, are allowed if you run a dispensary. Now, cost of sales are allowed because when this was put in the law, there was concern that under the income tax, as it was part of our Constitution, that you could not exclude cost of sales, that you weren't authorized to exclude cost of sales. And there was a theory that said that if they did that, this section might be ruled unconstitutional. So they allow you the cost of, as amusing as it may be, the cost of the weed is what you can take as your deduction, even though that's supposedly the illegal substance that's causing you to lose the other deductions. This case is a little different. In this case, and there were business reasons why they did it, because there was concern when they first set up this operation as to what exactly a dispensary could do besides simply dispensing marijuana. So they set up a secondary management company. This company provided management services. It actually hired all the staff that worked in the dispensary, took care of their payroll, took care of paying all those sorts of things. But they never actually took title to the marijuana. The dispensary company, which was a C Corp, always kept title to marijuana. The dispensary company paid the S Corporation, which was the management company, a management fee. And from the management fee, the S Corporation would pay the salaries of all the parties, would pay the other administrative expenses, you know, would basically pay everything related to it. Question is, can we actually claim the deduction? The taxpayer said, look, we aren't actually selling marijuana, because we're a management company. We're providing these services to the marijuana company, you know, the dispensary, but we're not really on our own selling the product. We never actually get title to the marijuana. As such, we believe that we're really not in the, we're really not trafficking in a controlled substance. And 280E limits deductions if you are trafficking in a controlled substance. They're saying, look, we've never done that, right? We don't do that. We agree, you know, dispensary, fine. They traffic in the substance. You know, they actually claim deductions there, but okay, we're going to let that one go. You know, sort of that one, okay, we understand what 280 applies, but it really shouldn't apply to us because we don't own it. Oh, and secondly, it would be wildly unfair. You're denying a deduction to the dispensary for the amounts they pay us for management fees. We're having to pick those up as income because nothing says it's not income to the person receiving it. But now you're going to deny us a deduction for like the salaries and things that we pay from that fee. In essence, aren't you really denying the same deductions twice? And that can't be the correct answer. Well, the tax court took a look at what is trafficking under the law. And the tax court, looking at prior cases, looking at cases in other areas, decided that in fact, trafficking in marijuana doesn't really require that you ever actually take ownership of the marijuana. They are still involved in, they said, basically what you're doing is totally allowing people to acquire marijuana. You're moving it. You're getting all the people in there. You are certainly doing things that are directly involved in moving the marijuana. You know, this is different than, let's say, somebody like the utility company. Yes, they're turning, yes, they're providing power. That power in the building allows them to grow the marijuana. And allows them to sell the marijuana, you know, because people would like to come into some place that has some light to see what's happening. But there, you know, that wouldn't be removed enough. But they said, no, this management company, clearly, its entire business model is to assist in the sale of marijuana. That makes this management company being involved in the trafficking of marijuana. As such, 280E applies. And that double deduction situation, the tax court effectively says, tough luck, guys. They said, look, you decided to structure your business this way. Nobody made you do it this way. There's no requirement to do it this way. And they said, and it doesn't matter because 280E says anybody in trafficking and both the dispensary and the management company involved in trafficking. So the dispensary is going to lose its deduction for the payments it makes the management company, you know, for the management company to provide all these things to it. And the management company is going to lose the deduction because it's still trafficking in marijuana, so it also cannot deduct the expenses for all those employees and other expenses that are incurred. Is that a harsh result? Yeah. What it really means is if this stands up, and we don't know if there'll be an appeal, and if there is, we'll see how it goes. But assuming that this stands up, by doing the structure they did, they essentially created taxable income out of thin air. By paying a management company a fee, they ensured that they would pay in addition to paying on the gross revenue, you know, the gross profit of the actual dispensary, they would end up also having to pay on top of that income in the amount of all the amounts that they are giving to the management company to take care of the other expenses. Yeah, again, it's dangerous. Working around the marijuana companies, in the marijuana dispensaries, 280E is a nasty provision. You know, the tax court apparently has decided that they don't want to give anybody any ideas that we could use a management company or something similar to kind of get around and evade this little problem. So we don't need to worry about it. We need to worry about it. It's going to be a problem. It's something for us to keep in mind. Next up, finally, we've got this. We got the IRS this week on their website made this statement about they issued additional guidance on changes to excess business and operating losses. This is IRS News Release IR 2018-254. It was issued on December the 18th. And this is involving the issues involved on two different issues. Section 461L of the code. That's the excess loss deduction rule. 461L says that if a taxpayer who's a married couple filing a joint return, if they have net business losses in excess of $500,000, that any amount in excess of that $500,000 has to be disallowed in the year you incur it and then carried forward to the following year as net operating loss. If you are not married filing a joint return, you have any other filing status, that 500 drops to 250. Now, the net operating loss issues, as we all should know by this point, we've lost the ability to carry back NOLs unless you are in a farming operation or you are basically a property and casualty insurance company. And generally, when we carry those losses forward that we incur in 18 or later years, we can only offset 80% of the income with those losses coming forward. So the IRS put this new page up about this. Hey, where are we going to find information? Well, they tell us that the Form 461 should be released soon. We now do have the 461 draft and the 461 draft instructions. In theory, we are coming up real soon now to a final Form 461, and they claim that will make everything clear. Well, it's going to need to go a lot further than what we have currently on the 461 instructions and the 461 form that we have now. There's a lot of unexplained issues. Some of them may be answered by the Blue Book, but some of the problems we know that exist here is, basically, we know that we do not know if we incur that loss. Let's say we have a $2 million loss this year. So we disallow $1.5 million. Do we have to test that $1.5 million next year also against the $500,000 net business loss rule? And if we do, then, you know, it's going to take a lot longer to use that up. If not, then apparently the whole $1.5 million would come through next year. We also don't know, will things like sale of stock in an S corporation that has a trader business inside of it, will that be considered trader business income? Because conceivably what could happen is, let's say we'd had passive losses from this S corp for years. We sell it. Let's say there's a highly appreciated asset in there that we've just not really converted to a positive cash flow yet. That's why I have these big losses. And we sell it for a substantial gain. Well, can we treat that S-corp gain as business income, which would allow us to deduct more of that released loss? Or is it going to be considered to be an investment-type sale, not deductible? We don't know that at this point. So we have a lot of unanswered questions. You know, the NOLs, less issues there, but still not a whole lot of guidance. What they give you is they have this one page with a quick summary for each. They link in each one's case to another page that has a not whole lot longer discussion of these issues. Again, we're going to be looking for some information on this. We've been told that the actual regs on 461L will probably not be out to the middle of next year. That's when they're scheduled if we look at the regulatory guidance schedule. So it's certainly going to be a problem. I would suggest, though, there is a discussion of the NOL issue, at least obliquely, in the Blue Book under this area. So this is one where you may need to go back to the Blue Book. You do need to take a look at Form 461. You do need to take a look at the instructions, and especially when you get the final version, because I think that's what we're going to be working with for most of next year. Like it or not, we're kind of stuck with that. That's the best guidance that we have. Well, we're getting down to the end of the CPE year now. This is kind of your last chance for State Society CPE courses, because we all know after January, we're all going to be stuck with tax returns we have to get done, and not really be a whole lot of time to be taking a bunch of continuing education if you're in tax. But most state CPA societies are offering options and programs in January. You want to check them. A lot of them are offering webcasts of various sorts. We expect to have the final regulations of 199 Cap A next month at some point. So assuming we can get that out in time, you know, that doesn't come out February 15th, I would think that it'd be very, very likely we're going to see some continuing education courses on that issue, at least webcasts. I'm certainly going to be talking to some state societies about looking to set that up if we actually get a chance to run that. You'll also be, you know, a lot of people are doing tune-ups for tax season. You know, we're going to be doing that sort of thing. I'll be doing a couple of those. We're going to be talking about a tune-up, what's changed, what has to be done, what you'd be looking at for this year to get ready for this tax season. First one under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. We have the other standard stuff. We certainly, I'm going to be doing a couple of days in Oregon this month. Going to be doing fringe benefits on one of those days. That'll be kind of interesting because we'll get to talk about the parking lot tax one more time. We all love that tax so much. And I'll be doing a couple of days here in Arizona in January as well. Then I'll also be doing a bunch of in-firm sessions during the month of January. But check your state CPA society catalog. They've got a bunch of options. And again, we are now finally seeing the final regs come out under Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. I suggest if you have a chance, get a current version, a current live broadcast or live session dealing with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in January, because we are just now getting guidance in some areas, and it's possible we're going to discover that the final regs may have some differences from what we had in the proposed regs. It's going to be important you understand those differences as you go to work on stuff for your clients this year. Okay, this has been the current federal tax developments for the week of December the 24th. You can follow our regular updates online on the website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I have posted all of the stuff that's happened so far there, discussions on the various issues that have been going on. So if you want to go there, we've got a couple more things up there. As I say, I didn't decide to go through them this week. First, I thought you guys would like a slightly shorter podcast this week. And secondly, yeah, I think I'm going to need stuff for next week because, again, we've got a government shutdown going now. So I'll probably may get some court cases, but I have a feeling I'm not going to get a whole lot of IRS, you know, notices, revenue rulings, etc. to talk about. So we're going to have to kind of work with what we have next week. You can send any questions or comments to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com is the best email address to use for this. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at edzollers. We've been bouncing around lots of things there, including that issue of the new publication 535 and why it's not in line with the proposed regs. And the question is, does that tell us something about the final regs, which would be disconcerting if it does? You can also follow me in various discussion forums. Like I said, I normally follow the Reddit group at /r/tax/taxbros, the reddit.com/r/taxbros. You go to Reddit, you join groups, you look at that, you look for Tax Bros, you'll find our group. I also regularly try to post in the forums, the Connect forums for the Arizona Society, for the Minnesota Society, and for the New Jersey Society. And I posted some information about these things that have happened this week on those forums. From time to time, I'll take a look at California's Tax Talk group. So if you have an option to get into those groups, you know, go ahead and post your questions there. Tax Talk should be open to any CPA anywhere in the country. It looks like a busy week. It looks like we're going to have a little bit of fun to work with. I'm going to hopefully be able to get all the way through the comprehensive partnership audit regime reg, see what's changed there. We can talk a little bit about that next week. I'll talk a little bit about Publication 535 as we see if we can thrash out. Does that really tell us that we're going to have problems with real estate agents? Real estate brokers, insurance agents, insurance brokers, or is it just that the pub's wrong? And we'll take a look at some of the other neat things that have been going on. But in any event, we should be back, and probably I think I'll get it out next week. So we'll have one final New Year's Eve version of Current Federal Tax Developments to close out 2018. It's been one interesting year, and I hope to see you next week, and we'll talk to you about what the end of 2018 brought us as we get ready for the beginning of 2019, and as we all know, the beginning of a brand new tax season.